welcome to this video, and I've had so many requests for Mr. Andrew Bridgen, Member of Parliament, to come onto the channel. I'm delighted Mr. Bridgen has come on this morning. So, Andrew, welcome, and it's a real privilege and a pleasure to have you on the channel.
And it's a privilege to be invited on and to get a chance to speak, John, and I'm looking forward to your questions.
What I'd like to do, first of all, if you don't mind, if we could just trace your thinking over the pandemic years. As it, I mean, mine has certainly evolved quite a lot. There's been realisations, pennies have dropped, disappointments have occurred. What's your sort of development since early 2020?
I think I've developed in a way very similar to yourself, John. I am actually double vaccinated with AstraZeneca, something I deeply regret now. And when I went and got those vaccines in my constituency, I actually posted pictures of myself having the vaccine, which will be seen by my constituents and others. And again, I deeply regret that. But as Einstein says, you know, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do? And the sort of growing concerns around the whole pandemic response from the lockdowns to the rollout of the vaccines, it all sort of compounded. And I started researching using some of my old historic knowledge from university, speaking to, I mean, I have very good access to academics and medics, and also through the House of Commons Library, I can get any paper from anywhere pretty much instantaneously, or certainly within 24 hours. So I carried on researching, and I wasn't liking what I was hearing. I voted against the Plan B. I really researched Omicron, and I spoke to some of the South African doctors and scientists, and I think the way they were treated and their evidence was treated by our parliament, I found it really quite insulting and smacked of racism to me. I mean, when we remember that South Africa was the place where we had the first ever heart transplant, their science was good, their evidence was good, and I stood up in Parliament in December 21, opposed Plan B, pointed out that I believe that Omicron was probably the best Christmas present we could ever have had by the attenuation of the virus to something less pathogenic, more transmissible. And what we also knew is there was no lockdown measures going to stop an R rate of 12 or 14. China couldn't do it with those extreme lockdown measures. So I voted against the masks, the mandates, and all those restrictions. And clearly, obviously, when I found out that that Partygate broke, and that those at number 10 who were privy to the best science, the latest figures, they weren't concerned about social distancing or masks. No. And I think the other thing that really got me, John, was during the lockdowns, which I voted against after the second one. I mean, the suicide rate in my constituency went up 400%. We were having more suicides in a month than we'd have in a normal year. And I really wanted to speak out about it, but I was so concerned about copycat. And quite honestly, for a failed policy, I just hate the idea that my constituents and other people were just seen as pure collateral damage.
So unlike most of your colleagues in Parliament, you do actually have a science degree. You've studied genetics and biology, which is refreshing. So that gives you a good understanding of what's going on. One of the things that's concerned my viewers an awful lot, Andrew, is you've stood up in Parliament and given evidence-based rationale. And there doesn't seem to be any interaction. So, you know, what I'd expect is you stand up and say, well, this evidence here from the reanalysis of the vaccine paper shows such and such. This is inconsistent with the government thinking at the moment. You would expect some interaction. Someone would say, well, just a minute, let's go back and look at that data, or let's compare that with data from someone else, which shows a contrary view. None of that. Why is it that they don't seem to want to academically, intellectually interact with your evidence?
I don't think they're used to that level of scientific analysis in parliamentary debates. The ministers are not appointed by their scientific qualifications, generally. You're right. I mean, obviously, this is a contentious issue, and we know the mainstream media narrative. So, I mean, every speech I gave on the vaccine harms was fully fact-checked by scientists and doctors prior to me giving it. And then obviously I produced a press pack immediately. I sat down with all the papers itemized. And I think the first speech on the 30th of December to try and deter the government from vaccinating small children. I mean, that, I think that had 32 scientific papers and analyses attached to it. And the problem is as well, I mean, what you've seen, John, is time and again, when I put in for a contentious debate that's going to be difficult for the government, they don't even put the minister up who's actually responsible. Yeah. So it gives a get-out-of-jail-free card for the stand-in minister to say, well, if this is neither my speciality nor my area of responsibility, and I will write to the honourable gentleman. Well, I mean, we had all that on the 17th of March. What I can tell you, John, is that the government didn't write to me with the answers to those
questions.
I've now gone back to the minister, Will Quince, and pointed out to him that he's a good chap, really, and he did promise me he'd answer those questions, and I don't want to have to raise a point of order in the House of Commons.
Mm-hmm. Overall, though, I get the impression that your interventions, although there's like an official blind ear been turned on to them, I actually get the impression that you've moderated some of the government behaviour. So even though they haven't interacted publicly because they can't be seen to go against the narrative, for example, you know, the autumn booster campaign was for the over 55s, not for everyone. The current campaign, frantic backpedalling, is now for over 75s and those with significant comorbidities. I mean, and to many parents' relief, we never vaccinated babies in this country as they've done in the States. And I feel your interventions have had a moderating effect on that. Do you think that's the case?
I believe so, and I hope so. But I think also what it's done is it's moved public opinion and awareness. And it's that is the, in a democracy, surely it's the view of the people and the pressure they put on their elected members of parliament. I know it's had an effect because colleagues in the House of Commons have rather slyly said to me, Andrew, for goodness sake, don't give another speech because we can't stand the emails. So clearly people around the country are doing the right thing, putting pressure on their elected representatives to raise issues of concern. And I don't think there's anything more concerning than public health, the vaccination of small children, who you, John, you've pointed out the science is there. I mean, there isn't a healthy child of that age group who has suffered death due to the virus, but clearly there are risks associated with the vaccine. So it never made sense. Mm. And I'd known for quite a long time, and I was wanted to speak out, but it was when the MHRA, the Medicines and Healthcare Product Regulatory Agency, pushed the government for approval for those experimental vaccines down to children of the age of 6 months. That's when I felt I had to speak out. And also I thought that was something that the science was so clear and the risk-benefit analysis so starkly that even the most pro-vaccine member of the public, I felt I would be able to explain to them that this was a risk not worth taking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I've had literally thousands of comments on, Andrew, is the fact that when you've given your well-researched, well-reasoned, fully referenced, expert-consulted speeches in Parliament, very often it's been to an empty house. Is there, comment on this as you will, but is there a deliberate walkout strategy or is it apathy or what, it's just so impolite. You've done all this work. You've got a cardboard cutout junior minister who reads out some response which bears very little to what you've said. Is this deliberate or is it apathy or why are we not got a parliamentary debate going on?
Well, adjournment debates at the end of the business of the day are used by members often to raise very local issues. I mean, I've seen them up on the screen, you know, bus services in Bolton. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily expect a lot of interest from the whole House for such a local issue. But the issues I raised were not local. They were questions that were affecting every household, every community, every constituency in the country. And certainly after the first speech, when I was announcing I was going to give another one, I mean, there was considerable awareness amongst colleagues and their constituents who were emailing their MPs saying, could you please attend this important debate? So maybe the first speech, but certainly not the second. At the end of the day, John, I can't answer for colleagues' behaviour. I can only answer for my own. It is a huge issue. And as you know yourself, the interest around this issue is not restricted even to the UK. It's global, and it's growing very rapidly, quite rightly. So you would have expected considerably more engagement from my colleagues than we've had. And I'm sure they've had plenty of emails.
Yeah, and those pictures shown around the world have done British parliamentary democracy no good at all. Basically, that empty house has held us up to mockery in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. It just makes the system look farcical.
It has, but I mean, you have to remember that when I speak even to an empty house, an empty chamber, that is recorded in Hansard, and it does go out as a video clip. I think it's the narrative that we're up against to get to the truth and the science. I think it's fairly damning when YouTube will take down a speech with a response from a minister from the mother of all parliaments for 3 days because it violates their community guidelines. That is deeply worrying. I did give a speech a couple of weekends ago in Norway, in Stavanger, to a conference on these issues. And I stood up on the stage and it was a packed audience. And I said, I'm actually feeling a little intimidated. I'm only actually used to speaking to an empty room.
Yeah. Who's paying for these vaccines, Andrew? They're costing us billions, aren't they?
The taxpayers paying for the vaccines.
Have we got plenty of spare cash at the moment?
We know it'll be going on the national debt. And I think that's... the last speech I gave on the 17th of March on the vaccines... I did point out the cost of the number to vaccinate to prevent one hospitalisation or one serious hospitalisation, and it's interesting that after that speech, within a few days, the criteria was moved to only the over 75s, and it did mention for the first time value for money. There is no money. There's no government money. It's all taxpayers' money, I think a large number of our parliament have forgotten that. Mm-hmm. I think some of them also have forgotten that we're not the masters of the people, we're the servants of the people. And I think the next election may be an opportunity to remind a few people a few facts of life.
Absolutely, yeah. Answer this to the degree you see fit, Andrew, of course, and bear in mind this is a public domain channel, but is there influence of corporate interests in parliament?
I think people know that the current parliamentary system we've got, it doesn't appear to be working for the people anymore. And I actually have said publicly that I'm very, very concerned that what we should be doing, and we used to do, was we passed laws and legislation on behalf of the people, for the people. Mm-hmm. And now it appears that we actually have a whole parliament, not even a government, but a whole parliament that's conspiring to inflict laws upon the people. And that is not democracy. And the use of Project Fear and the PSYOPs during the pandemic, and also, John, I mean, I like to, when my constituents come to me with problems, as they do, and they can be anything from the front door to my council house needs replacing to, very personal issues. I like to, they're clearly worried. I always try and reassure them and say, now that you've told me and my team, it's normally on a Friday. I want you to have, relax this weekend because we'll deal with this now. Have confidence. And that's what I think governments should be there for, to look at the problems the country faces and deal with them and let the people get on with their lives. But what we've seen increasingly is every issue from pandemics to climate change, it seems to be pushing the concern onto the people instead of dealing with the problems that the country and the world faces and let people get on with their lives. It's almost making people feel responsible for these issues. You're the problem. And I find that deeply, deeply worrying and unpalatable, quite honestly. And it's the anathema of what I came into politics for.
Yeah, yeah. Just a question on parliamentary issues and procedures, because most of us don't know about these things. We saw a video of a Mr. What was his name again? Matt Hancock, I think. saying he would offer his services to outside interests for, I think it was £10,000 a day. Is that allowed?
He wasn't shy, was he? He knows his worth, that man. £10,000 a day. It's not, for backbenchers, it's not against the rules to have other jobs. I mean, if there's any defence of that, clearly, if you couldn't have another job, you could never take a ministerial job because you haven't got time. But being a backbencher, there's as much work as you want. I mean, right. And also what you have to bear in mind is that MPs who don't get casework, i.e. people don't come to them with problems, in my experience, that isn't because there are no problems in your constituency. It's because your constituents have written you off as useless. So in fact, the harder you work as a backbencher and the more you sort out people's problems for them, for your constituents, the more they tell people and the more people come. Yeah. I mean, I sometimes think, John, that some people think that MP stands for miracle performer. And there are a lot of people out there looking for a miracle if you can try and provide one.
But the Member of Parliament in the United Kingdom is such a precious entity to me, to democracy. Because if my MP writes a letter on my behalf, if he takes the time to take an interest in me as an individual, that can actually change things. And if you're too busy earning £10,000 a day, you're going to have no time for the hoi polloi, the riffraff, the ploditariat, like me. Well, as you can tell, that engenders strong feelings.
Yeah, but ultimately you get the MPs, the representatives you vote for. There are no qualifications at all to be a Member of Parliament. You don't have to have any qualifications. The qualification, the only one you need, is you have to get the most votes at the election. And they do say that the public get the politicians they deserve. Well, some of them must have been very bad in a previous life, I think. The sign of Parliament is a portcullis. That is the last protection of the castle when the drawbridge has been breached. I think we also need to bear that in mind, because I think some of the things that have gone on over the last few years, we certainly have not protected the public how our Parliament was set up to do. But then, you know, neither have all the institutions and agencies that were tasked with doing that. There's some very, very bad decisions. When you come back to corporate influences, I mean, it's very difficult. If our Parliament is not serving the interests of the public, and we look around, it's not just our Parliament. I mean, some very strange decisions on policy are being made in democracies all over the world on the same issues at the same time. And, you know, they didn't all have Matt Hancock mishandling the COVID response at the same time. It was all done independently. It's very difficult not to see a coordinated pattern of behaviour, which then leads you to believe, what could it be? And global corporate interest would appear the logical answer.
It's true. You've got, I hadn't thought about that. You've got similar movements in New Zealand, Canada, the United Kingdom, parts of the United States, quite a few European countries, all happening at the same time, moving in a similar direction. It does seem one heck of a coincidence, doesn't it?
And Australia and New Zealand as well. Yeah, you see, yeah. So it's a worldwide phenomenon of people making, probably, which will turn out to be, if they're analysed properly, the wrong decisions about the same issue at the same time. John, you could become a conspiracy theorist if you're not believing in things like that. I was thinking I might have to get some new conspiracy theories, because all the ones I had before have all been proved right now.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. Andrew, I want to play it. Now, we know, and real commiserations for this, the party that you've worked for and given your blood for over decades has rejected you. And I want to just play a clip here from our mutual friend, the esteemed emeritus professor now, Norman Fenton, and just get your reaction to it, if you don't mind. Is that okay? It's only just for about a minute.
I want to say a few words about the furore yesterday over MP Andrew Bridgen's suspension from the Conservative Party for supposedly anti-Semitic remarks. Now, I'm Jewish, and my father was a Holocaust survivor from Poland. In fact, he was the only survivor from his entire extended family. I didn't find Mr. Bridgen's remarks at all anti-Semitic. Mr. Bridgen has been one of the few MPs to have raised the concerns about the serious adverse reactions from the COVID vaccines. And I'm worried that these claims of anti-Semitism are being used to divert attention away from these serious concerns that he's raised.
Yes, and it was absolutely, I mean, it's humbling to see Professor Norman Fenton come out to defend me at considerable risk to himself from the narrative and the mainstream media. I think he's absolutely right. He also was one of 25 signatories of leading Jewish scientists and doctors who wrote to number 10. And the point they made was that they believe that the government were falsely accusing me of anti-Semitism and racism, and that by doing that, they diminish clearly real incidences of this. And also that they considered the actions of the government were to suppress free speech in the House of Commons. And clearly, with their religion and its history, they were deeply concerned that that was the first sign of a totalitarian regime, which is to stop free speech. And I think when you see people like Matt Hancock and Lord Bethell, who served in the health department during the pandemic, now pushing to get vaccine disinformation, misinformation included in the online harms bill, this is just another layer of censorship.
Yeah.
And as I've said in the chamber, and as you've said to your subscribers many times, I mean, science is like politics. It doesn't work without debate and discourse and disagreement. And then if you can't defend your thesis or your political ideals, then they're on probably pretty shaky foundations. And no science is ever settled. The politics is never settled either. And neither should it be. It should always be up for debate. And cancel culture is not the future of science, and it's not the future of free speech, and it's not the future of fair and open democratic politics either.
Couldn't agree more. And just to clarify the anti-Semitism red herring, basically, I read in a mainstream media outlet, BBC, last few days ago, from their website, the Conservative Party has expelled MP Andrew Bridgen after he compared, that's from the BBC, 3 days ago, I've put the reference in, COVID-19 vaccines to the Holocaust. That was on the 26th of April, 2023. You know, this concerns me and you didn't do that, of course.
I was actually retweeting a world-famous cardiologist with a paper supporting his arguments from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And his comments were that the vaccine rollout was the biggest crime against humanity since the Holocaust, neither denying the Holocaust or saying that this is worse than the Holocaust or diminishing the Holocaust. In fact, saying that the Holocaust was the biggest crime against humanity that I can ever think of.
Concerning on two levels. First of all, they're using Matt Hancock, I believe he said your suggestion was disgusting in Parliament.
Disgusting, anti-Semitic, racist. I'm anti-scientific and a conspiracy theorist.
Let's clear that up. Are you anti-Semitic?
Absolutely not. And I've got ethnic minorities as members of staff, and you've been called a racist. I mean, that is so deeply upsetting for me.
It is.
It really upsets some of my staff deeply. But it is the dog whistle for shutting someone down is to call them a racist and an anti-Semite.
I'm called a racist, a misogynist, and various other ists and phobes and all sorts. And again, I completely refute that. But this is concerning on two levels, as you've already said, Andrew. Firstly, they're using this to sidestep the real issue, which is your scientific case. And secondly, it just diminishes anti-Semitism, which is real. Members of our Jewish community do experience anti-Semitism, and that is a real issue.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And to diminish this, I just find it appalling. There we go. I think we've cleared that one up. I mean, it's... So in my view, your interventions have saved lives, and you've lost your party membership. Has it been worth it?
I knew that by intervening with regard to the vaccination of small children, I knew that there'd be a huge backlash from the government and they wouldn't like me going against the narrative. But I knew that science was on my side. I knew I could get the people on my side. And I knew that it wouldn't be in vain, that we could change the policy. and protect those young children from a potentially dangerous and experimental vaccine, which they didn't need and was going to be no benefit to them. The only winner was going to be Big Pharma, who'd make even more money out of pushing those vaccines onto small children. And there's got to be a line in the sand somewhere, and it's all right towing the party line and being a loyal party member, but there are after some things, and I think, you know, the protection of young children's health, if the line's not there, it's nowhere. And what am I in Parliament for? I've actually got a four-year-old myself, and whenever I look at Blake, I just think, well, you know, there's no way that he's going to be used as a guinea pig for Big Pharma.
Really brings it home, doesn't it? And I know that myself and I could speak for probably all of my viewers, or the vast majority, respect someone who pays a personal price for protecting the weak. So I'd just like to thank you for that on their behalf. The future, Andrew. The government signed a deal with Moderna to produce 250 million doses of messenger ribonucleic acid vaccines a year at a big plant, New Oxford. Good idea?
Well, it's a very experimental, novel treatments, which have never been properly tested. I think if we actually analyse the vaccine harms, as I've pointed out, we should never have approved those novel vaccines to start with. They're not really vaccines, they're gene therapies. The definition of vaccine had to be changed. No, not at all. And I'm deeply worried about it. The government basically seemed to have said that the only treatment for future pandemics is mRNA vaccines, which can produce very quickly, which means no safety testing. But also, I fear that all the traditionally safe childhood vaccines that we've known are now going to be converted to mRNA, with the consequent risk factors. We know there are risks with every vaccine, but they're fairly minimal for the traditional vaccines, which would be a dead or inert part of or a whole virus, not an antigen coded for by messenger RNA.
Why on earth would you chuck out something you know that works? We know traditional vaccines.
Tells you they know what the 10-year prognosis is for those of us who've been vaccinated. They don't, do they? Because we haven't had that time. We've had these. What we do know is from our own yellow card system that there's been more yellow card reports of suspected side effects from the novel mRNA vaccines and the AstraZeneca DNA vaccine with the adenovirus vector in 2 or 3 years than we've had for 40 odd years of all the combined traditional vaccines put together. I mean, I'm also very concerned that the yellow card system is not going to be publicised anymore. I'll let you into something, John. We found out that...
Just between you and me.
Just between you, me and the English-speaking world. Top secret. That the government have now given a contract out to a company called Commonwealth, several million dollars, to analyse with AI the yellow card system. And when you trace back Commonwealth, they're actually a subsidiary of a company in America called Genpak, and their biggest customers are AstraZeneca and Pfizer. So no conflict of interest there. So the contract has been given by the MHRA, who are 86% funded themselves by Big Pharma, to a company which is funded by Big Pharma to investigate complaints against Big Pharma using AI. Had I been in the chamber on Thursday, it was a bit hectic last week, I would have raised this issue with, and I know that she loves answering my questions. Penny Morton loves answering my questions. She looks forward. She would have missed me on Thursday. But I will have her, we'll have to ask the government these questions about the conflict of interest once again that the new company appointed to protect the British public are completely owned and in hoc, but their biggest customers are Big Pharma and the vaccine manufacturers. So nothing to see here. Nothing to speak to at all.
And there's new plants planned, I believe, 100 million doses a year to be produced in Canada, 100 million doses a year to be produced in Australia. Maryland, of course, the home of Moderna, we believe that's expanding as well. So,
well, it all fits in with the WHO treaty, which I spoke about a week or so ago, and the changes to the International Health Regulation, which you've commented upon. I think that the plan is clearly set in place that those are going to be approved worldwide. That's going to give huge powers to the WHO to call these public health incidents of international concern, abbreviated to FAKE, John. It's quite interesting. It's a FAKE. For any reason, they can do it for environmental reasons, human pathogens, animal pathogens, or the risk of a pathogen, CO2 levels, huge powers. But what's clear is that the WHO made a lot of mistakes in their dealing with the last pandemic, and they haven't learned from it. So they're still maintaining that the only solution to pandemics is novel mRNA vaccination. Well, if they're still not admitting that you know, there were effective treatments, antivirals and prophylactics, which could have been used, you know, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, vitamin D, or something as simple as that. They're still not admitting any of that. So clearly, if we're heading on this path to the WHO having control of the world during a pandemic called and decided by them, and their answer is mRNA technology, I mean, Moderna are onto a huge bonanza. I think at some risk, huge risk to the public, especially when you look at Dr. Joseph Fryman's reports based on data from America, that the Moderna mRNA COVID-19 vaccine was potentially the one with the highest number of serious adverse events, with one in every 662 from Moderna's own data would be resulting in hospitalisation or death.
Yeah, I had a Moderna vaccine, and I deeply, as with you, I deeply regret that. So the national governments would basically be obliged to implement, using the power of the state, dictates dreamt up by unelected, often poorly qualified, people in Geneva, often not paying international taxes, we believe, with diplomatic immunity, or a form of diplomatic immunity.
I can't think of anyone who could be more unaccountable or remote from the concerns of my constituents in northwest Leicestershire. I think they're the last people that we'd want. And I mean, obviously, I was fairly vocal during the referendum on leaving the European Union. I led the Leave campaign, which was very successful in the East Midlands. My own seat voted by 61% to 39% to leave. The East Midlands was 59% to 41%. It wasn't close here. And the people in my area of the country voted that they didn't want to be ruled by unaccountable, unelected bureaucrats from Europe. Well, I mean, anyone who was concerned about the loss of sovereignty to the European Union, I mean, that's nothing compared to the powers that we'll be giving away to the WHO. We've got a very, very dubious history of respecting human rights. Oh, well, that's Article 3, the human rights aspects, that they're all being rewritten and they're taken out. So there won't be any respect of human rights in their charter anymore. It's going to be a bland statement that everyone will be treated with equity. Well, if they're treating everyone fairly badly, John, that's equity, isn't it? Yeah. And I don't want that for my constituents. I don't want that for my family, and I certainly don't want that future for my children. So I'm going to be opposing that all the way.
Do we need medical advice from the WHO? Have you not got any doctors in northwest Leicestershire? Have you not got any scientists?
Well, we've got some of the best universities in the world, and also there's a huge risk of a one solution problem for the world. If the WHO get it wrong, and they've certainly got, I believe, a very bad track record, that's the whole of humanity finished. Yeah. If different countries adopt different strategies, at least we can also learn from them and say, well, that's working well in Sweden, and that's not worked in Australia, and we've done this. We can share best practice. And also, you know, our populations will behave differently to different stimuli due to traditions, and we've got different climates, which could well affect you know, it's summer in the UK when it's winter in Australia, and that can affect, as you know, viral spread. So how could one policy for the whole world actually be applicable and relevant given all the geographic and demographic differences? One size fits all. And I think, as I said in that debate on the WHO, you know, if there was only one car available for everyone, I'm not sure it would be the best car we could have without any competition or innovation.
Absolutely, yeah. Last question, Andrew, and thank you for all the time you've given us. We shout loud about democracy in the United Kingdom, but it only works really realistically through the party system. So where does this leave you at the moment, personally? Just answer this to the degree you'd like to.
Well, I've been expelled from the Conservative Party. I could appeal, but given the way the original, the spurious nature of the original allegations of anti-Semitism and racism and bringing the party into disrepute, I don't have a great confidence. I think there's a lot of politics being played out here. I think they want to silence me. And I'm not going to allow that to happen. I think as long as I am elected, I will speak out. And the next election, I will be standing. And my future will quite rightly be in the hands of my electorate. And I'll be judged at the ballot box. And I think that's quite right.
Absolutely, yeah. Mr. Andrew Bridgen, Member of Parliament, North West Leicestershire, biologist and campaigner. So many people appreciate, we just feel that you're speaking for many people that are otherwise voiceless. So,
and that's what keeps me going, John. Whenever I feel isolated, I look at my emails and it's fine.
And I suspect we might get a comment or two under this video, Andrew, as well.
So. You never know. You never know. Yeah.
It's Saturday morning. Please spend some time with your family. Thank you for giving us up this time. And we will be following you with interest and appreciation.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.